Our opening words this morning come to us from the Reverend Kristen Harper, called Each Day. Each day provides us with an opportunity to love again, to hurt again, to embrace joy, to experience unease, to discover the tragic. Each day provides us with the opportunity to live. This day is no different, this hour no more unique than the last, except maybe today, maybe now, among friends and fellow journeyers, maybe for the first time, maybe silently, we can share ourselves. Our reading this morning is an excerpt from a book by Reverend Barbara Brown Taylor, an Episcopal priest. The book is called An Altar in the World. Some of the most reverent people I know decline to call themselves religious. For them, religion connotes belief. It means being able to say what you believe about God and why. It also means being able to hold your own in a debate with someone who believes otherwise. They, meanwhile, are not sure what they believe. They do not want to debate anyone. The longer they stand before the Holy of Holies, the less adequate their formulations of faith seem to them. Angels reach down and shut their mouths. Reverence may take all kinds of forms, depending on what it is that awakens awe in you by reminding you of your true size. Nature is a good place to start. Nature is full of things bigger and more powerful than human beings, including, but not limited to, night skies, oceans, thunderstorms, deserts, grizzly bears, earthquakes, and rain-swollen rivers. But size is not everything. Properly attended to, even a salt marsh mosquito is capable of evoking reverence. See those black and white striped stockings on legs thinner than a needle? Where in those legs is there room for knees? And yet, see how they bend as the bug lowers herself to your flesh. Soon, you and she will be blood kin. Your itch is the price of her life. Swat her if you must, but not without telling her she is beautiful first. The easiest practice of reverence I know is simply to sit down somewhere outside, preferably near a body of water, and pay attention for at least 20 minutes. It is not necessary to take on the whole world at first. Just take 3 square feet of earth on which you are sitting. Paying close attention to everything that lives within that small estate. You might even decide not to kill anything for 20 minutes, including the salt marsh mosquito that lands on your arm. Just blow her away and ask her to please find someone else to go eat. With any luck, you will soon begin to see the souls in pebbles, ants, small mounds of moss, and the acorn on its way to becoming an oak tree. You may feel some tenderness for the struggling mayfly the ants are carrying away. If you can see the water, you may take time to wonder where it comes from and where it is going. You may even feel the beating of your own heart. the miracle of ingenuity that does its work with no thought or instruction from you. You did not make your own heart any more than you made a tree. You are a guest here. You have been given a free pass to this modest domain and everything in it. So I am forever getting phantom calls and phantom messages on my phone. My phone, often in my pocket, I can feel its vibration. I swear it's going off. I pull it out, nothing. It has this hold on my psyche. The thought that someone might be trying to reach me, something important or entertaining might be going on somewhere, that thought is always there, like a little nibble in my brain, so much so that my leg is buzzing about it. An online marketing company reports that every minute, 204 million emails, 16 million text messages, 350,000 new tweets are sent every minute. Every minute, 86,805 hours of video are streamed by Netflix subscribers. The list goes on, amounting to streams of content and communication that invite us to unlock our phones 80 to 110 times a day. This is all part of the attention economy, an idea first articulated by economists in the 70s, and now a major approach to information management, given this digital culture we live in and the mind-boggling proliferation of entertainment and social media. Attention economics begins with the premise that our attention, our capacity to notice things, is a scarce resource that digital companies vie for, enticing us with endless content and social networks. So we scroll, we stream, we click, our phones merrily buzzing away in our pockets. Sometimes when they're not actually even buzzing in our pockets. Slow me down. I need to think and pray. My time is running out, our choir sang for us this morning. The poet Jenny Shea wrote about what we are up against in this attention economy. The word attention, she wrote, stems from the Latin ad tendere, meaning to stretch toward. Our attention determines the direction toward which we stretch our minds, yet all too often exercising our attentional power feels less like intentional movement towards some select object of contemplation, and instead feels like the passive bracing for an onslaught of sensory input and competing stimuli. She goes on to write, perhaps it comes as little surprise how easily we fritter away this resource of attention when one considers the fact that its capture and commodification fuels a multi-billion dollar industry. We're up against some pretty powerful forces. She writes, we are living through an attentional crisis, and what's at stake is how we spend our waking hours. The very nature of our lives, it boils down to a matter of autonomy and who we allow to have ownership over our consciousness. So I've tried various strategies, as you may have, to limit my phone's ownership over my consciousness. I've used screen time tracking, I've deleted certain social media apps, but the fact is, when I have a random moment of time, I'm waiting for a coffee, I'm waiting for a bus, I'm reaching for my phone and I'm unlocking it. It keeps me, come on! This calls for a drink of water. Is that somebody's phone? It's a nice song. Okay, so thank you. My reflex is to take it out and unlock it, and it keeps me connected. Don't get me wrong. I know the value of being connected to friends and family, to the people in my life, to you all. But it also isolates me. It pulls me away from the present moment. It fills every moment with information and content, layering distraction onto a busy enough existence. When I first read that piece that I shared as our reading this morning, it was during the height of Triple E awareness. Everybody knows Triple E, Eastern Equine Encephalitis, this disease transmitted by mosquitoes. So Reverend Barbara Brown Taylor's invitation to study the mosquito's knees, to gently blow the mosquito off my arm, seemed especially uninviting to me at the time. We had just spent some time as a family in Wareham, which was like one of the highest risk areas for Triple E. So we were at the playgrounds, or we were walking through the forest to get to the beach. I was like laser-like focus on the air surrounding my child. My eyes were just scanning the space, and I saw these sort of like phantom specks, and I'm like, I don't think I had ever paid such keen and focused attention to the air surrounding anything as I paid to that air. And I swatted a lot of things that may or may not have been mosquitoes. It was a reflex, certainly different than the phone addiction that I've been talking about, but similar in that I just couldn't stop myself. So that's one kind of paying attention, but maybe not exactly what Barbara Brown Taylor was getting at. My reflexive swatting and unlocking my phones are examples of unintentional attention. I move through the world like this all the time. So many of us do. Unthinking, hurried, stressed. Slow me down. My time is running out. I need time to think and pray. The early 20th century Unitarian minister and theologian John Haynes Holmes wrote this of prayer. Prayer is attention unfolding into intention. It is purpose, resolution, dedication, which brings us face to face with the greatest of all spiritual discoveries, that if our prayers are to be answered, we must answer them ourselves, that we are already answering our prayers in the mere expression of the desire that they be fulfilled. John Haynes Holmes was a proponent of the social gospel, a Protestant movement in the early 20th century that emphasized faith's call to us not just to personal transformation, but also to social reform. Holmes lived his convictions through a life of activism. He was a co-founder of the NAACP and the ACLU. He was also an ardent pacifist and took an uncompromising and very unpopular public stand against US involvement in World War I. He was ridiculed and ostracized for this, including by the former US President William Howard Taft, who at the time was the president of the General Conference of Unitarians. You guys didn't know you were gonna get some UU trivia this morning. So Holmes resigned from the American Unitarian Association due to the hostility that he and other pacifists faced. His congregation in New York City, formerly Church of the Messiah, agreed to reorganize themselves as the Community Church of New York, which they are still today, so that he could stay on as their minister after this resignation. Tomorrow is November 11th, now called Veterans Day. November 11th, as many of you may know, was originally a holiday known as Armistice Day, commemorating the end of World War I in 1918. As a veteran and peace activist, Rory Fanning notes, Armistice Day was sacred because it was intended to evoke memories of fear, pain, suffering, military incompetence, greed and destruction on the grandest scale for those who had participated in war, directly and indirectly. Rory Fanning goes on to write, Armistice Day was a hallowed anniversary because it was supposed to protect future life from future wars. Now, 101 years after John Haynes Holmes took this stance against World War I, a war that was supposed to end all wars, and we are still besieged by war. John Holmes's faith and his understanding of the will of God called him to take his controversial pacifist position, and called him to all his social reform endeavors, lasting contributions like the ACLU and the NAACP, which, as we know, continue to fight for freedom and against discrimination. So given what he believed and what he did about what he believed, Holmes's assertion that prayer lends us purpose, resolution, dedication, is a testament to how prayer can be a resource, strengthening our intentions to make change in the world. Prayerful, intentional attention is also a resource that helps us remember our interconnectedness. The paradox of our phones is that they can keep us connected, but they also keep us apart. I can think of more than one instance in recent memory in which my partner Adam and I are both home on the couch together, each of us on our phones, not talking to each other. How do we escape our phones and reconnect? Barbara Brown Taylor invites us to immerse ourselves in the outdoors to practice prayerful presence. She suggests sitting outside and paying attention for 20 minutes. She suggests that this can remind us of our place in the world. "You did not make your heart," she writes, "any more than you made a tree." We are dependent, contingent beings, and we're not the only ones around here. On my way home from a shift as a hospital chaplain at Bregman Women's, riding my bike along the bike path, my heart often felt heavy, overwhelmed with the stories I had heard all day, worried or sad about my patients and their loved ones. I would stop at Jamaica Pond, which is on my way home, lean my bike against a tree, and sit at the water's edge. I did this in freezing rain, in sweltering heat. Sometimes I lingered longer than others. Regardless of the weather, I'd pause for at least a little while, and I'd pick up a few stones. I would think of each of my patients and toss the stones into the pond, watching the water splash and ripple. As I did this, I offered people's stories to the pond for safekeeping. The pond is much older than I am, much older than any of us. Sometimes I'd get all in my head about hospital chaplaincy, worried I'd say the wrong thing, afraid I wouldn't be enough for whatever situation I might find myself in. Sometimes I felt much too alone, especially on the overnights when I was the only chaplain in the hospital, on call for whatever emergencies might unfold. Whenever I needed to ground myself, I would visit the chapel, a quiet place with a richly colored carpet and soft, dim lighting in stark contrast to the shiny, bright loudness that you'd find everywhere else in the hospital. In the multi-faith chapel at Brigham and Women's Hospital, there is a small board propped up in the corner on a counter. There's packs of sticky notes and pens right there on the counter. The board is covered in these sticky notes with messages that people have written. And overwhelmingly, what people write on these sticky notes are prayers. They write expressions of gratitude for healing, for the medical team. They write pleas, petitions for recovery, for good outcomes, for good test results, a second chance, a miracle. Prayers for a peaceful transition out of this world if someone had reached the end of their road. They wrote notes of love and heartbreak to the dearly departed. I could almost hear everyone's whispered prayers as I read through them. I could feel people's faith expressed in these petitions and these laments. It felt to me like there was a giant beacon of light skyward from the hospital. It was like I was reading the human side of a cosmic conversation, and the message is love. This prayer board helped me pay attention to what was most important, my place in this community of care, and by turns, my place in the world, in the universe. It reminded me that I am not alone in the hospital, far from it. Even when I was the only chaplain there, the place was full of people caring for one another, sitting vigil at bedsides, working hard through the night, holding hands. Visiting the chapel, like my visits to the pond, helped me remember my connectedness. I am one of many, and I am part of something beyond myself. I can lift up the prayers of others. I can add my prayers to this infinite pool of prayers. There is no limit to how much we can pray. When we are intentional about what we pay attention to, when we can regain some autonomy over our attention, we can reclaim it from all this streaming and scrolling. It gives us more time for ourselves, for one another, for our relationship with God, or all that we hold most sacred. Our intentional and prayerful attention allows us to be present to what matters most: the people we love, the earth which sustains us, the preciousness and precariousness of this life we are living. So slow us down. We need time to think and pray. Would you join hearts with me now in meditation and prayer as I read these words by Teresa Novak? Pray with me now, if you will. I think we need to pray. Pray with me now, not out to some great intervener, a handsome stranger coming to the rescue. You don't have to barter your soul, your mind, your free and restless spirit. Pray with me now. We need to pray loudly sometimes, giving voice in word or gesture to the urgent fires within our hearts, screaming out, "Why this? How long?" Screaming out for help, for courage. Outrage, sorrow rumbles through our veins, and the pulse of our prayer is ragged. Pray with me now, if you will. I think we need to pray. We need to pray softly sometimes. Our silent bodies held still, a quiet hope rising to the wind, blowing about the world in wonder. Pray with me now. Pray silently or out loud. Our very prayers are an answer. The pulse of life, of hope, in our oh-so-human hearts. May our prayers be heard. I invite you now into a time of quiet prayer. You may pray silently or out loud, whatever it is that's on your heart. Amen, and blessed be. Our closing words come to us from Nancy Wood. Hold on to what is good, even if it is a handful of earth. Hold on to what you believe, even if it is a tree which stands by itself. Hold on to what you must do, even if it is a long way from here. Hold on to my hand, even if I have gone away from you.